Good evening and welcome to The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon on WDIY, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Drabenstadt, your host this evening. We'll be bringing you The Inside Dish the first Monday of every month. We'll be taking you on a culinary tour of the Lehigh Valley and its amazing food scene. Tonight we'll have two guests who'll talk about the passion that they bring to their craft. First, we'll have Sam Mazzotto, the owner and brewer at Bond Place Brewing on the south side of Bethlehem. And then we'll be joined by Sean Doyle, owner and chef at Savory Grill in Cecilsville in the southwestern part of our listening area. It's going to be a tasty show, so sit around the table with us for the next 30 minutes and enjoy The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon and WDIY. So Sam, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Sam, how would you describe Bond Place Brewing to someone who has not been there before?
Oh, wow. Okay, I told you that there was going to be questions that everybody asks us. I guess that's one I've never gotten before. I would describe Bond Place Brewing, you know, almost entirely the way I envisioned Bond Place Brewing, and that's there's a nice sense of community there. I mean, you've been there, and I'd actually be curious to see how you would describe it to me in order to answer that question. And that's very it's almost I'm being a politician now, but not to put it on you, but I suppose if I were in another part of the country, you know, or maybe overseas, and somebody said, "Well, what kind of place is it? What kind of brewery is it?" I'd say it's a small brewery on the south side of Bethlehem, and it's a really nice place for people to come together and talk about beer and enjoy beer and conversation. You know, as you know, and maybe a lot of the listeners, people who are listening to this, or maybe they don't know this, we don't have televisions. We don't have many distractions. It's sort of a step back in time in a lot of ways. And it's really beer-focused, which was exactly my intention. And by my intention, I mean my wife and my intention, but I take that ownership sometimes. It was our intention to have Bond Place be a sort of studio or a theater for beer. Very much these days, with craft beer especially, it is about that beer theater. It's about the presentation, everything from the glassware to how the beer is poured or the ambiance. I really subscribe to the fact that beer is visceral, and this is a very involving the five senses. And, you know, the smell of beer, the taste of beer, those are very obvious. The look of beer, as long as it's in a clear glass, that's pretty obvious as well.
Now, are these things that come to you naturally in terms of your decision to choose glassware, to not have televisions? Is it something that's just from your gut, or are these things that you researched in terms of what you wanted to accomplish?
A little bit of both. I'd say, you know, I've had the fortune of being in the industry for 10 years, very much involved. I'm 35 now. I've been involved in the industry, we'll say, since I was 21, if anybody was listening that would care about what age I was. But I've been actually in the industry. I started in New York, and I was in the craft beer industry I've been in the craft beer industry for the last 10 years. And through working at the Pony Bar in New York City, for instance, in Hell's Kitchen, or at the Newburgh Brewing Company, or helping out at Chelsea Brewing Company, and really getting to see what their focus was, or what was interesting, or what worked and what didn't work. And I'm not saying that everything we do works, but I got a really good feel of it. But the other thing of it was, Gina and I, my wife and I, don't have a television at home. So, you know, we don't have a microwave at home. The only thing we do have in the brewery, besides the actual brewery that we have at home, or we don't have at home, is we don't have a dishwasher at home, but we do have one in the brewery. We're pretty analog folk. You know, we're pretty old school in that way.
So in many ways, the brewery is an extension of the way you live.
It's our living room. And if I have to spend 16 hours somewhere nearly every day of the week, I want to make sure it's somewhere I'm comfortable. But it, you know, like attracts like. So, yeah, to answer your original question, I would say Bond Place Brewing is a comfortable little beer hall, beer house on the south side of Bethlehem in a very post-industrial world. And we get the best people. It's just a really comfortable community. It's community, you know, and that's what's really nice. It's community around beer, and that's been growing. And in that way, we're very successful, which I couldn't be more thrilled about.
Well, Sam, take us back. I don't know how many years it will have been, but tell me about your first experiences brewing beer, about when that was and how you got into the whole practice of doing so?
It's very interesting. So both my parents are from Italy, and I guess it's very interesting to me. Forgive me. It's interesting to me. They're from Italy, and so I come from a long line of, we'll call them artisans. I think for them, they would shun the word, but I come from a long line of people who sustained themselves, whether it was making wine, cheese, bread, pasta, pizza, whatever it was. We'll be more stereotypical, but they did everything. And wine was a big part of my father's heritage, living in the mountains of Sicily. My grandfather had a cantina that would put some American wineries, not to shame, but certainly keep up with it. It was incredible, what they were doing, what they were producing. So I've had an interest in it, or I've been involved with it or exposed to it for many years. Even my family, the limited amount of family that did come to the States has been involved in winemaking too. Nobody professional as far as I know, but I've helped my uncle press grapes and, these sort of things. And even my father-in-law does it. So for me, I had a great interest even back in high school, and I would hear about breweries and I would hear about distilleries, and I was like, wow, that's applied knowledge. That's applied science. I would have done a lot better in chemistry and biology if I had some of that
right
on my side. 3 days before my 21st birthday, I had a really bad motorcycle accident. It made me sort of think, hey, this is fleeting. I'm going to drive to California. So I drove to California with a buddy of mine. This is 2002. And I had a Samuel Smith oatmeal stout on the Colorado-Utah border. And that beer just, it was a paradigm shift. It was like, wow, this is what's possible. Like, this is beer, huh? Like, it doesn't have to be. And at that time, I was probably, Genesee Cream Ale was very high on my list, Sam Adams Boston Lager. And these are beers I still drink, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. Some may call them pedestrian, but in a lot of ways, they're the granddaddies of what we're doing. And they are to be respected, especially with the consistency. And I did have that Samuel Smith, and I was like, wow, this is something totally different. And then I met my wife in college a year later or so, not even. And we were drinking Yingling Black and Tan and Guinness and all these, full flavor stouts and, porters. And then we were going to the local brew pub. And I said, this is something I want to pursue. So I became a bartender and an actor in New York City, and maybe in that order, in fact. And through bartending in New York was really where I got my opportunities in the craft industry.
Well, tell me a little bit about inspiration for the beers that you make. I know on tap now you have the Wild Apple Tart. You have a wild sour ale.
Mm-hmm.
You also have the Imperial Black Saison.
Yes.
Which I've been fortunate to enjoy. Tell me a little bit about your thought process in terms of how you develop the beers that you want to bring to the people.
A lot of them are homebrew recipes that I worked on and developed and then just propped up, or how do you say, I altered the recipe for production, for my production, which is not huge. We're a 7-barrel brew house. Generally, I get about 5.5 barrels, which 31 times 5.5, we're talking about 186 to 200 gallons of beer at a time, as opposed to 5. So the process was really, for me, I was really fortunate to work at a brewery in upstate New York called Newberg Brewing Company, and my boss there is he's an incredible person, very good friend of mine, and we became really good friends. We actually went to high school together, played hockey together, but we became really good friends later in life. And he worked for Brooklyn Brewery for 7 years, and he really instilled a lot of that in me. A lot of it just comes from inspiration. The muse may be anything from Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending Staircase No. 2, or anything from a famous painting to some music that I'm listening to. But really, we go for a lot of continental European styles. I lean way UK, and I lean very French Belgian, Franco Belgian in my style. So I pull inspiration from that. The Wild Apple Tart, actually, you just named two of the beers. Often people come in and say, give me your favorite. And I say, do you have children? And they say, yes. And I say, well, who's your favorite kid? I can't choose a favorite beer.
That's a tough question.
But there are beers I'm proud of. You named two of them that I'm particularly proud of because they came out. The Merci, the Imperial Black Saison, came out exactly the way I intended it to, which is really exciting. The Apple Tart, I had no idea what to expect. That one, I wanted to be 100% Pennsylvania. And that's what it is. So the malt is from Deer Creek Malt House. I'm sporting their cap right now. Those guys are awesome, and they do some really high-quality stuff right here in PA, grown and processed. So Deer Creek Malt House malt. The hops came from a buddy of mine's, we'll call it a farmette, basically his backyard. Those are all homegrown Cascade hops. The water, obviously, is our watershed. The apples I use to inoculate it and for the cider aspect of it are from Shoals, and they pressed the cider for me. They did 50 gallons for me, sort of specifically, and I was able to let that inoculate itself and ferment. So the yeast, we'll say the fifth ingredient, but the fourth ingredient, according to the purity law, is also Pennsylvania, because it's whatever was ambient. And this was it was sort of, I guess, risky, because you can't tame that. But it came out super. I mean, I'm really excited about that beer. We were going to put it in oak, but then I figured if I put it in oak, that may not let those ingredients speak for themselves.
But it sounds like an oak might be in the future, maybe for round two next year.
Yeah, subsequent batches may receive some oak treatment. We do have, what I did with that yeast is I was able to harvest some from that batch, and I pitched it into my cherry sour that I have it's in my oak fermenter now. So I did a cherry sour in a stainless fermenter, just like I've done my other sours. And now I'm moving that one. That one's resting. She's laying down in oak until probably around Christmas time. I'm going to be brewing a tiramisu beer this Tuesday. What came with the inspiration for that was growing up Italian, my parents would make tiramisu every year. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've got to try that.
Yeah, that'll be Christmas time, I think. That's a Christmas beer.
So let's talk about the craft beer industry in general. I mean, 1986, there were 124 breweries in the country. By 2000, there were over 1,500, and I think the total is going to be close to 5,000 next year. I mean, are we at a saturation point? Is there still space for brewers coming online here? Tell me about your perception of that.
My perception, because there's a lot of schools of thought on that, and I've spoken to a lot of people in the industry, and I've heard people like Jim Cook speak on it, and Dick Yingling, and we've heard tons of people talk about it, and who knows what their real position is, again, being a politician almost, but I know my take on it is there is room for growth. There's no more room for bad liquid, and, you know, whether I feel like my beer is good or not is, you know, that's how I feel, but there's very little room for that in the industry anymore. So I feel like what we're going to see is more things like what I'm doing, and that's the local brewery, you know, being a beer hall and being the focus is that the beer is made on premise, drank on premise. That's not to say that there's not going to be growth. You know, breweries like Trogues and Victory are growing. There are big breweries that are not macro. They're big craft breweries that have seen loss in sales as far as I've heard. So I think it's going to balance out. I do think it's going to plateau, and if people go through what they have to go through to open a brewery, it's not the easiest thing in the world. I don't know that there's going to be a ton of people opening them, but we are – the wine industry, there's – I forget how many wineries there are in this country. I want to say 9,000. Don't quote me on that, but if there could be that many wineries, there can certainly be that many breweries.
I think there's still some space.
I think there's some space.
Certainly there's space for Bond Place here on the south side of Bethlehem. So, Sam Mazzotto, thank you for joining us here on The Inside Dish.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And, to all the listeners out there, we'll see you at the brewery.
Great. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. Stay with us for the second half of The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon on WDIY.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
If you are a Golden Age folkie and love the music of Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, Judy Collins, Joan Baez, and the Kingston Trio, WDIY is the place to be on Monday nights. From 7 to 9 p.m. on folk classics, all of that great music from the late 1940s to the late 60s will fill the airwaves, and we will welcome your ideas about the artists and songs you'd like to hear. Folk classics, Mondays from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on WDIY.
Hey, welcome back to The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon. We're glad you can join us for WDIY's monthly program on the culinary arts. I'm your host, Mike Drabenstadt, and for the second half of the show, we are joined by Sean Doyle, chef and owner at Savory Grill in Cecilsville, correct?
Correct.
All right. So, Sean, welcome to The Inside Dish.
Thank you.
You're celebrating your 20th year at Savory Grill, right? 1997?
Correct.
So tell us about your professional journey that took you to that point of opening Savory Grill back in 1997.
I guess it started in 79 with my first job and then progress from that point.
And your first job was?
Actually, in Bethlehem. My uncle bought a small restaurant where they serve food at. And just by chance, one evening, my brother couldn't go to work. So they said, hey, is there any possibility of you coming in? And I went into work and as a dishwasher and just enjoyed myself and kind of got drawn in from that point on.
So it wasn't a conscious decision in your youth where you said, I want to work in the restaurant business. You came in as a dishwasher and now you moved up the ranks, right?
Correct. My mom I always helped my mom in the kitchen and basically enjoyed cooking, but it wasn't a passion by any means. But once I got into a kitchen, saw the havoc, the stress associated with it, and just at the end of the night when you know that you got through it and it worked out well, it just inspired me. So went from there.
So for people who haven't been to Savory Grill before, how would you describe the restaurant, both in terms of the decor and also the food that you provide?
Well, it started out based on food. Basically what it came down to is in the early 90s, I would think that the customer base became more educated on what food was, where it came from, were more intrigued by it. And kitchen people tend to be a little less informed. So I was looking for something that I could be a little more creative and express a variety. So the whole concept was is that we wouldn't stick with one particular style of food. We'd change the menus frequently. So then came to the concept of finding a place. We were looking for somewhere that had some property that we could raise our kids. So we were looking primarily in the country where we could have something where we could, you know, grow some produce, grow some herbs, stuff like that, and raise the kids in a great environment. And Macungie, which is where we're located at, Hereford Township, is just a great area, agricultural climate. So it's just a beautiful area to start a restaurant.
You mentioned that you want to provide different flavors and different dishes to your customers. How often do you change the menu?
I change it. I retweak it every day. So I reprint up a menu. We keep it fairly simple, but keeping it more diverse. So we don't really stick to a particular style of food or region of food. So I try to change it every week and a half, 2 weeks from top to bottom. You know, keeping it very minimal, 9 entrees, 9 appetizers, you know, 3 salad dressings, several, you know, 6, 7 different desserts. So we're making everything in-house and basically, you know, creating new dishes continuously, keeping it fresh.
Considering that you do like to offer a variety of dishes and maybe explore some different cuisines, how do you find those items that work with one another that you might have appetizers or an appetizer from one genre, maybe a salad dressing that might be from a different type of cuisine. How do you mesh all those things? How do you find a way to make them work?
Good question. I'm finding out these days that people are very eclectic. We've seen a lot of cross-cuisining going on over the last 30-some years where people like doing a lot of what we used to call in the 80s as fusion cuisine, where you're pulling regional items from, say, France and bring it in an Asian cuisine, like with Vietnamese food. So I don't really think there's any really boundaries from food style from one area to the next. They kind of mesh really well, and people's tastes are very eclectic these days. You know, I don't believe our guests are very restrictive on what they're looking for. They're just looking for something different, neat, fresh.
Now, that's
interesting.
To me, that's different than how things were in the Lehigh Valley back maybe when you started or back in the early 1990s, where there was a level of predictability. I mean, for a night out, you'd go to the Village Inn and get the veal marsala.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, correct.
So tell me a little bit about how that has evolved for you in the last 20 years.
Well, I still believe that most of those dishes are the basis for what we've created new dishes on now. But we've seen a lot of variety as far as freshness. More flavors that pop where you're not necessarily doing the stew-based sauces where you're marrying flavors across the dish from beginning to end, where you're doing stuff that's more an a la minute preparation where it's quick and fast, where you're getting different textures, different flavors, and different contrasts of ingredients on the same dish. So it's changed to a benefit. You know, we're looking at appearance of a plate as well as nutritional value as well as textures. So it's a piece of art nowadays.
A lot of different layers.
Yes, correct.
So tell me a little bit about how you're inspired in terms of the dishes that you come up with and the new items that you put on the menu. Where does that inspiration come from?
I'd say a little bit of everywhere. Early in the career, we're talking a lot of creative plagiarization, where we take other people's dishes and kind of retweak or add something that represents what we are as individuals being chefs. And as it evolved over time, we're talking a great deal of, you know, I don't necessarily play on the Food Network, but I do rely on my other colleagues, chefs. I belong to a bunch of organizations. I still am very active in, like, Lehigh Career and Technical Institute with the culinary program there, Northampton Community College, the culinary program there. So when we go there, we're looking for individuals that inspire us. You know, if I get bored, I'll go up to the Culinary Institute and get revitalized, you know, hit the library there. So I am begging, borrowing, stealing from whoever I can to create a dish. But over a period of time, you can figure out what pairs well with each other. You know, you rely on your peers who you're working with at the given point. But steal whatever you can from everyone.
Keep your eyes open and your taste buds active, right?
Correct.
Are there any particular ingredients that you would classify as some of your favorites? Not that maybe you use them all the time, because I know you use a lot of fresh ingredients and things that are seasonal, but are there ingredients that become fresh or become seasonal each year that you just can't wait to get your hands on again?
Yeah, it's kind of like when we get from season to season, right? Right now we're getting into, you know, great winter time. So we are talking some stew-based items. We're talking, you know, butternut, Brussels, you know,
and
things
squashes.
That are roasted. Yeah. And then when we get into wintertime, near the end of it, you're kind of like tired or bored of some of these ingredients. So you're looking forward to spring onions, ramps when they come about, morel season, things that just inspire you into the next season. And when that's ending, we're looking at all the fresh produce that becomes available, the herbs, the tomatoes, you know, squash blossoms.
So Mother Nature makes it easy for you to keep it fresh.
Yeah, right? And where we're located, and because of the number of farms and the number of people that actually produce stuff in our area, it becomes neat. They call, you know, tell me what they have available. And basically I'm creating menus around the items that are coming in the back door than to create a menu around what I think is going to be available.
So do you classify the restaurant as farm to table, or is that just sort of your philosophy? Because the whole farm to table thing is somewhat of a trend. Hopefully it's going in the right direction.
Correct.
But tell me a little bit more about your philosophy and if you see the whole farm to table thing being part of that.
I've got some accolades and some awards over the last few years as being best farm-to-table restaurant. You won't hear it out of my mouth that often. I think it's something that, you know, we want to reduce our carbon footprint. We want to know where our product is coming from. We want to be sustainable. But other than using these key phrases, we just, you know, where we're located at, we have access to so much. And when you ask about individual things that, you know, I look forward to, face it, high poultry in our area. We're talking some great duck producers, some great chicken producers. We can even get some great rabbits in our area. Now, I still like variety, so I'm still bringing in scallops, but I'm bringing them from suppliers that are backhauling a lot of product, so we're not talking a great deal of a carbon footprint. So I'm justifying what I'm buying and how I'm buying it for what I want, but my customers, I think, are looking for variety.
Okay.
You know, they don't want to be, you know, coming to a place and there only being four or five items on the menu, because you are farm to table and those are the items that are available. So
now I think a question that a lot of people have when they talk to a chef, and certainly your wife is also an accomplished chef, Dorothy.
Correct. Yep.
People want to know what you feed your family. Are you are you cooking the same sort of things in the restaurant, or are you going with grilled cheese and some tomato soup?
After work, I look forward to a sandwich that I can pick up somewhere else. Yeah, I don't necessarily eat what I produce on a consistent basis. There's a lot of byproduct left that I feed my family normally. So I still look forward to a roasted chicken. you know, good home-cooked meals, stews, things that I don't necessarily serve at the restaurant that I just find, you know, especially this time of year, inviting.
Inviting, very comforting,
yep.
Very
comfort food,
family-oriented, come around yep. the table, huh?
Yep, throw something on the grill and just sit back and sit on the porch and relax.
In fact, for listeners who are cooking at home or maybe looking to cook a little bit more, what sort of advice would you give them to either be more proficient or enjoy that process a little bit more?
Think about what you're buying and be very I like buying 4 or 5 ingredients that I can use multiple different ways during a given week. So just be a little forethought, you know, more than anything else, that you're keeping it fresh and keeping some variety, that you can buy a potato and serve it 4 different ways to make 4 different meals. So.
And I also imagine the whole idea of being inspired too, try different things and then maybe try to replicate that in the home.
Correct. You know, and these days it's a lot easier because we have availability of so much product out there.
And certainly a whole lot of variety here in the Lehigh Valley that
That's
maybe we didn't
sure.
have years ago.
That so. Is for sure.
Sean Doyle from Savory Grill, it's been a pleasure to talk to you tonight. Thanks for coming into WDIY.
Thank you.